Okay, thanks Robin, or Robin, for your very brief introduction. Good morning. I'll be talking today about the in vitro assembly of simple, i.e. unenveloped, single-stranded RNA viruses, and how, by applying fairly simple principles borrowed from soft matter physics, how I can build minimum models that at least rationalize experimental data and in some cases quantitatively describe experimental data. We've had two virus talks so far. Still, I think it's useful to remind ourselves what a virus is, if only just to set the stage. A virus, if you reduce it down to its core essentials, is essentially a bit of genetic material encased in a protein box. This protein box is called the capsid of the virus. The genetic material can be RNA or DNA. It can be single-stranded, double-stranded, partially double-stranded. It can come in one strand or two. All this depending on the type of virus that we're talking about. The viral capsid, the protein box, consists typically of very many copies of a single coat protein or a couple of coat proteins. And the shape of this protein box, the capsid, depends, again, on the type of virus. One usually distinguishes three classes of virus. The most important, or the biggest one, being the class of the spherical viruses. And this electron micrograph that I nicked from the internet is an example. This is herpes virus. It's a biggie. If I'm not mistaken, this is actually the capsid that contains the genetic material. This is about 100 nanometers across. This greenish thingy is the envelope of the virus. It's burst open, which is why you can actually see the capsid, and it consists of a complex of lipoproteins. If you look carefully at this image of this virus, you can already tell that the proteins that make up this rigid shell, that the proteins are organized in a very regular fashion, and that, in fact, we have already seen yesterday as well. Now, the second class of viruses is that of the filamentous viruses or helical viruses. This is an example. This is a tobacco mosaic virus. It's about 300 nanometers in length and about 20 nanometers in width. It contains a single RNA of about 6,000 kilobases. The RNA is wrapped inside this rod-like structure in a helical fashion. Finally, we've got our third class of virus, which is the class of viruses which do not belong nor to the spherical viruses, nor to the filamentous ones. It's a fairly broad class of virus. And this is a representative. This is a bacteriophage which combines these two motifs. So you have a spherical capsid on top and a helical rod connected to it, which is hollow, which is involved in the injection of the DNA into the host cell, in this case, a bacterium. Now, I shall be focusing entirely on single-stranded RNA viruses, the reason being that there's a whole bunch of them that in vitro have been disassembled and reconstituted. So first one, in fact, was TMV, this virus. You can disassemble it into the constituent protein molecules and RNA, separate the components, put them back together, and they will form effective, all by themselves, infective virus particles. In fact, there's a whole bunch of, as I already mentioned, a whole bunch of viruses for which this has been possible, in particular small plant viruses. In fact, if you would only take the protein of the virus, then put that in solution, and under the right conditions, this coat protein will self-assemble into a virus-like particle, sometimes indistinguishable from the real things, so the actually live virus, sometimes self-assembling into a shell which is different. In fact, some of the smaller plant viruses are also known to be quite promiscuous, meaning that you can take the RNA from one small virus, the code protein from another, mix them, and they would quite happily form infectious virus particles. In fact, experiments going back to the late 60s have shown that one could even encapsulate synthetic RNAs, homopolymeric synthetic RNAs, or even quite generic polyelectrolytes such as PSS. So this has led to the idea that at least in vitro, that the self-assembly of these simple viruses is thermodynamics driven. And if that's the case, then we can apply, then we should be able to apply principles from soft matter physics and try and understand how factors like the concentration of protein, the pH, salt, temperature, etc., affect the assembled state of the viruses. So that's an introduction to an introduction. The work I'll be discussing today was done with a whole bunch of people, which I've listed. This is me. For those who wonder what TUE means, that's Technische Universiteit Eindhoven. That's the place where I work. The person who got me interested in viruses was actually Willem Kegel, who is now at Utrecht, who actually used to be a postdoc of Howard Rees at UCLA. Actually, Willem was appointed a full professor 2 weeks ago exactly. So big cheers to... Hey!
I didn't do anything.
Bored already, that's quick. Help!
Any
really?
Space bar.
Ah. Now I want to go back. How do I go back?
Back arrow.
Ah, right. Thank you. Bloody theorists. With Willem, I worked on the physical regulation of the self-assembly of hepatitis B virus and of tobacco-mosaic virus. This Ruby Brunsma, who was kind enough to invite me 2 years ago to stay at UCLA for a couple of months. With Robin, I worked on the encapsulation of polyelectrolytes. Then there are Roy Azandi, now at Riverside, then at once at UCLA, David Regera, now at Barcelona, and Howard Rees, with whom I worked, amongst other things, on the kinetics of a capsid assembly. And these are the topics that, if you allow me to, at least, I'll be covering today. Probably not. Okay, so I like to show beautiful pictures, and you'll be seeing quite a few beautiful pictures today. As already noticed yesterday, I think by Dennis, you can get beautiful pictures from the internet. There's many sites devoted to viruses to be found. I'm just showing you to give you a bit of an idea of the size scale that one encounters. This is the scale bar. It's 50 nanometers across. You've got really, really tiny viruses, like satellite tuberculosis virus. Satellite referring to the fact that this virus doesn't have enough genes to reproduce itself, to replicate itself, so it needs co-infection by another virus. There are also big ones, like Bluetongue cord. This is 50 nanometers across. The largest virus, if I'm not mistaken, is close to a micron in size. It's Mimi virus, I think. It's a huge virus. It has, I believe, something like 600 to 700 genes. So that's quite an exciting new insight.
Which of those is RNA virus or DNA virus?
Well, bromosaic virus is, for instance, an RNA virus, single-stranded RNA virus. Tobacco mosaic virus is an RNA virus. FD virus is an RNA virus. For the rest, actually, hepatitis B is actually, it's a DNA virus, but it starts out with a pre-genomic RNA. So it's an RNA virus that turns into a DNA virus.
DNA is just general.
Yeah.
Like, DNA viruses should be double-stranded DNA.
Not always.
Not always.
No.
Sometimes
yeah. And sometimes they are partially double-stranded.
SV40 is a true DNA virus.
Right.
So there
Thank
should
you.
Be a major distinction.
SV40.
Like
simian virus.
Yeah, over here.
Yeah, something that is single-stranded virus should depend on DNA, on self-assembling, probably, right? Something that encapsulates double-stranded DNA of the opposite probably would want to hold it inside because it's so rigid and it needs pressure.
Right, so this is, in fact, why I'm focusing on single-stranded RNA viruses, because it doesn't need a motor protein to encapsulate the genome.
But looking at the shape, is it easy to say which one is which? Or do we,
no.
No.
The double-stranded DNA should be large and much more.
That's right, which is why you need a motor protein to actually squeeze it in at the expense of ATP.
SV40 doesn't have a motor protein. It steals the nucleosomes from the host to condense the DNA.
Okay. The other reason why I'm showing this picture also is because it shows how remarkably regular the proteins are organized on the shell. It's so the virus cells are actually essentially two-dimensional crystals wrapped onto the surface of a sphere. This brings me to the T numbers. It's been discussed yesterday, so I won't be going into it very much. The important thing to remember is that the size of these icosahedral spherical viruses is quantized. And the reason is that the underlying symmetry is that is icosahedral, and this icosahedral symmetry limits the number of proteins that can be absorbed into a shell. And the aggregation number of a virus shell goes like Q, Q being the aggregation number, like 60 times T, where T is the T number discussed yesterday. You can only have T equal 1, 3, 4, 7, giving rise to aggregation numbers of 60, 180, 240, 420, etc., etc. Here are a few examples. This is a picture, actually, I nicked from one of Zlotnik's papers. Poliovirus T equal 1, so it consists of 60 code proteins. Hepatitis B virus comes in two sizes, and this is interesting, I think. It comes in T equal 3 and T equal 4, both. Most of them in T equal 4, but a small, about 10% or 5% in T equal 3. This is bovine papilloma virus, T equals 7, it's a big one. Herpes virus, T equals 16, that's a huge one. That's the one that is about 100 nanometers across or something like that. So, as I already mentioned, the code proteins themselves will self-assemble into virus-like particles. Here are two of the more famous assembly diagrams that have been published. On the left, that of tobacco mosaic virus, code protein, and here on the right of a CCMV, that's a chlorotic, no. Cowpea chlorotic mottle virus, how do you pronounce it? Let's first look at the phase diagram quotation marks of TMV. Plotted here's ionic strength versus pH. I should mention, this is not a true phase diagram, it just shows you where certain types of assemblies are seen in experiments. There's two axes missing here, that being of concentration and temperature. So essentially, this four-dimensional phase diagram is compressed into a two-dimensional one. Anyway, at high pH, relatively low salt, the code protein will not assemble. High pH increased the concentration of salt, and lo and behold, a disk structure appears. This disk structure, it's a double disk, consists of exactly 34 code proteins.
No genome in the business?
This is, excuse me, thank you, there's no genome here present. It's purely only the code protein. At higher salt, these disks tend to act to form longer stacks, although the status of those longer stacks is not entirely certain, because they will only appear after a very long time. At low pH, this double disk structure forms a lock washer structure, as is known, and this lock washer structure very slowly develops into a helix.
What typical concentration this is corresponds to? How far apart are the original proteins? Because this is done at roughly the same concentration. What room temperature and what concentration?
Typical concentrations are like half a gram per liter.
Half?
A gram per liter, roughly. Obviously, the code protein doesn't form a single helix, it forms a whole distribution of lengths.
Which roughly for the regular kind of biological densities means like micromolar concentration.
That's right, exactly, yeah. But I find grams easier to sort of visualize than micromolars. because these are big molecules. Okay, I'll come back to this phase diagram in a minute. This is the phase, again. Yes, well, people have done scattering experiments and deduced from that that it must be an exponential distribution, I mean, as you would expect.
And the average size?
Average size is a function of salt or temperature that's been measured. And it follows an isodesmic assembly pathway. So here again, now phase diagram of CCMV, the spherical virus, ionic strength versus pH. Again, at high pH, you'll find, I believe, at higher concentrations only, but that's, I'm not entirely sure about that, sheets and tubes, higher salt, they dissolve for some reason to produce only the dimers. You have to go below pH 6 to actually produce the T equal 3 capsid, which is the capsid that the virus would form. At lower salt, you also find T equal 1 and multi-shelled viruses, virus-like particles. Now,
where in these diagrams is the physiological?
So physiological would be, thank you for asking, pH 7 about 0.1 molar salt. So pH 7, 0.1 molar salt over there. So this means that under physiological conditions, these coat proteins will not form these closed shells. So the proteins themselves regulate that they won't form empty shells, which is, of course, sensible. One remark, it's not a coincidence that for this virus and this virus, that something special happens around pH of 6.5. Now, this has to do with the formation of what people call caspar pairs. And caspar pairs are carboxylate complexes which form hydrogen bonds. And these hydrogen bonds stabilize the assembled structure. So why won't the coprotein form capsids under physiological conditions without genome? Well, this is more or less the reason. Here's an example of a coat protein. This is, in fact, the hepatitis B virus coat protein. And it consists of two bits. That's this bit over here, which is called the assembly domain. It's a dimer. It consists of two copies of the same protein, which are linked together by disulfide bonds. Its molecular mass is something like 35 kilodaltons. Attached to the C-terminal end of both monomers is what is known as the protamine domain. This protamine domain is very high in arginines and very strongly positively charged. For instance, for hepatitis B, it's been estimated that there must be something like 13 positive charges on both RNA binding domains, as they're also known as. So, as you might imagine, if you would dissolve this protein in water under physiological conditions, there's no way it will self-assemble. Unless you cut off the protein domain. You remove the charges, and then lo and behold, they will self-assemble into capsid. This capsid, was actually grown in E. coli, if you can call it that. So it was expressed in E. coli, and then inside E. coli, these capsids are formed. This is a cryo-EM picture of it, and here in the middle, this is, a model of it. An open model of it. It's a T equal 4 virus. If you don't remove this protein domain, then, and you express the coat protein in E. coli, then capsids do form, but you'll see this dark band here hugging the inner wall of the capsid. And this dark band consists of RNA molecules, not of the virus itself, but of the E. coli it was grown in. So, the presence of these RNA binding domains prevents coproteins from forming capsids under physiological conditions. You can change pH and force these proteins to self-assemble. This indeed is what happens at pH 4. This is a picture I nicked from the website of the virus group at UCLA. This is CCMV, electron micrograph. PH4 will quite happily form capsids. PH7 won't form capsids unless you do something. And that do something means, for instance, add a negatively charged polymer. In this case, the polymer, come on in. There's plenty of room. it's PSS. The experiments were done by Yufang Ho, Chuck Noble, and Bill Gilbert. They added high molecular weight polystyrene sulfonate to solutions containing the code protein from molecular weights from 600,000 and upwards. And what they see is that, in fact, depending on the molecular weight of the polymer, that the particles increase in size from T=3 to T=4. And there's a crossover region where you find both T=3 and T=4.
You said it's the cationic charge that prevents capsid formation?
That's right.
That if you lower the pH...
Right, that's a very good question, because this...
You make it more...
Right, yes,
so
no.
Why would it stabilize capsid?
It's because of the cusper pairs. So you have the cusper pairs come from acidic groups. So you put one hydrogen onto one of those.
What's the pKa of those groups?
Of one is between 2 and 4, but okay. If they're together, it's between 6 and 7. So this is no coincidence.
Okay.
So yeah, thank you. I'll come back to that because we try to model this.
For the non-chemist, this is referring to the C terminal of the protein, the COOH, which gets...
No. There are special groups and not part of that. So acidic groups like, aspartic acid and glutamic acid, whatever that means. I can draw the thing.
No, just
tell me. So coming back to your question, I mean, this is chemistry. Right? Someone said that the road from physics to biology went through chemistry. It's true. This has a pKa of about 2 to 4, depending on the direct environment. Now, say you would have two in close proximity.
The formic acid has 4.6.
Yeah.
What are these additional two lines?
Where?
Oxygen.
This is chemistry. These are electron pairs.
What is this?
Electron pairs.
Electron pairs. Okay.
Sorry,
I'm line next to the orbit of the right
oxygen
side.
Inside. Why are you drawing, them?
Because I'm a chemist, and this is what they teach us. You know, if you're unhappy, I can just...
Yeah.
It's the shell.
I know.
Yeah. This is what chemists do. I mean, I can't help myself. So say you would have another one sitting over here that's already been charged. Then to remove that hydrogen is very much more difficult because this one is charged, and you get electrostatic repulsion. So to get these both this happens at a pKa of about 7. So which is why in the phase diagrams I showed earlier, something strange happens around pH 7.
How close should it be for this to happen?
They're pretty close. Actually, the situation is much more complex than this because it typically involves something like 5 different groups. So, but this is sort of like the physics explanation-ish. Okay, so that answers your question, I suppose. Ish.
How close is actually fussy because you're really not talking pure electrostatics. You're really talking about empty orbitals and sharing.
So that has been very, very close. I don't think they're that close. That was my question.
They must be pretty close, otherwise it wouldn't. I mean, here, okay, this is in fact.
Well, pretty close depends on the salt concentration, right?
at low salt, they don't have to be.
Well, that was the
right
problem. It's not in the static.
I mean, you have to be extremely careful here because this happens inside the area where the proteins make contact, so there's not going
to
be a lot.
To do with salt.
No, no. Something I forgot to mention. It forms a hydrogen bond. And this provides you the energy. So, say 10 kBT per hydrogen bond, or something like that. Where was I?
We were explaining about artificial.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, you add the polyelectrolyte, it will form capsid, but the size of the capsid will depend on the molecular weight of the polymer that you add. So here you already have two factors that influence the size of a capsid. First of all, the protein itself, which has a preference for a certain size, for a certain radius of curvature. And then the stuff that you put in it partially also determines the size. So there's an optimum. Should also mention.
So if they're very high molecular weight, nothing forms?
Well, I think it was Bancroft who did experiments where he mixed the RNA of tobacco mosaic virus, 6,000 nucleotides, added that to the code protein of CCMV, which normally has encapsidates an RNA of 3,000, so it's double the size, and that will form capsids of T equals 4, T equals 7, all depending on the stoichiometry of the protein and the RNA. So stoichiometry comes in it as well.
All right. But here, do we know that the DNA, polystyrene is actually inside?
They did all kinds, yes. The answer is yes, but it took them a long time to make sure of that.
So, now, interestingly.
On the outside, it would form bridges, and they did see that initially they saw aggregation, and they had to go through a number of procedures to make sure that there was no polystyrene sulfate on the outside.
Right. These experiments are being done now. Also, on the other side of the planet, more or less, there's a group in Nijmegen who are doing the same thing, except that they add low molecular weight PSS of 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. And what they see, again, they see that virus-like particles form if you add PSS, but they're much smaller. Instead of a T equal 3, they actually find a T equal 1. I should say, I put a quotation mark here because they don't actually know for sure it's a T equal 1. It's based on the size. And you can tell there's a scale bar here that this is about, I don't know, maybe 20 nanometers across or something like that. Or even.
Yeah, the up one also looks like 20.
No, this is 28. This is about 28. And this one is actually less than that.
And aggregation is due to drying procedure?
Presumably. I wouldn't know. I didn't do the experiments. I mean, yeah.
But they're not in solution, they don't stick?
No. That could, under the right conditions.
Well, I mean, the conditions, but.
Right. But these are images, so you have to be very careful because they've been deposited onto a surface, etc., etc.
And very short, you mean stoichiometry, so there are several chains per capsid? Or
that's the idea, yes. And so the size of these capsids depends on the stoichiometry. So depending on how much code protein you have relative to the amount of polystyrene sulfonate.
It's not quantized. Because initially you have this blanky thing saying it's quantized.
Well, it's quantized in the sense that you have T equal 3, T equal 1. I mean, the sizes are quantized, but you have a distribution.
Spectrum.
You have a spectrum, a discrete spectrum. Now, so there's been this is just to show you that there is a renewed interest in this sort of experiment. I should mention that, I mean, people do experiments adding a synthetic polyelectrolyte because it has a relatively simple structure. I mean, RNA has a complex structure. Very difficult to control, which is why people resort to encapsulating simple polyelectrolytes. Although, I mean, some might say that PSS might not be the best choice because PSS is a very difficult molecule because it actually doesn't want to be dissolved in water at all if it weren't for the charges on them. So they might better have chosen a different polyelectrolyte, but this is the way it is. I can't help that. Yeah?
You see, RNA is so crucial to this assembly. It certainly suggests a pretty strong interaction with the proteins. Is it known whether the RNA at all adopts the sort of native conformations in the capsid? In other words, is everything you would infer from the secondary structure and so on for the RNA irrelevant once you put it?
Well, the tertiary structure of the RNAs actually change when they get encapsulated.
Yeah. But significantly.
So. Yeah. Oh yes, absolutely. Yes, you get something like 70% duplexes. Isn't that right?
Yeah. In some cases, it becomes completely duplex. But
so one should not think of the RNA as anything like it. Native
conformation. That's not quite true either, because if you take the secondary structure, and Yuri already mentioned it, you see these hairpins.
Yeah.
And these hairpins are very important for the assembly. If you cut them off, then assembly is much slower. So everything that Paul said is true, but if you take RNA with these hairpins, then you need far lower concentration to trigger assembly.
Okay.
Yeah. So as stoichiometry is the key.
Concentration of what?
Of the polymer. So if you take RNA, then you can assemble capsid at much lower RNA concentration.
It's not the stoichiometry ratio of capsid material to the electrolyte. It's not that much important. So you're saying lots of polymer left outside in this case?
Yes. In general, there will be polymer left outside and they wash it.
Right, but do you need, if you are working with stoichiometry, do you need to have lots of polymer outside in this experiment?
I honestly don't know. It's
apparently the concentration is equation of stoichiometry plus excess stuff.
So in case of RNA, if you take RNA and you have these hairpins, then at very low protein concentration you start to see encapsulation. If you begin to cut off these packaging sequences, then you need to increase the protein concentration and you start to encapsulate.
And this is a simple feature that the double-stranded thing is more highly charged.
And so, with this experiment, do you know whether the onset for formation is it significantly higher than that for RNA?
I don't have that. I don't have this information.
Yes, these are concentrations which are much higher than if you do it for
I mean, the amount of polymer they put in is something like 3 times the in grams than the amount of coprotein, or 6 times or 10 times. So that's the sort.
So charge ratio is what? Charge stoichiometry.
Well,
I think he's going to talk about
that. Yeah, I might be talking about that. If you give me the opportunity.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll get that, but that's all right. Somehow. Okay, so I said that there's a new renewed interest in assembly studies. The earliest assembly studies done go back to the 60s and 70s by Bancroft and others. In the 80s, there's actually a French group that have done humongous amounts of experimental work on the same thing. And the picture that emerges, I artificially separate two issues. You have the issue of the conversion of free protein into capsids, whatever the shape. So that's the polymerization part. Then there is the issue, okay, what is the structure of the polymer? Is it T=3, is it T=4, is it a rod, is it not a rod, whatever. Today, I'll be focusing mainly on this bit over here, and I shan't be worrying about what type of structure it will form. I will just presume that it will assemble into a certain structure and worry later about whether this is the most ideal one, yes or no. That's ongoing work, I should say. I've added a list of sort of buzzwords to try and get across how complex, in fact, the self-assembly is. I mean, the protein structure has, in fact, an impact on the sort of structure that you get, because, I mean, people have been tinkering around with genetically modifying the protein and going from T=4 to T=3. You add salt, we have actually seen that in the previous phase diagrams, is also state selector. pH is, the concentration of protein, in fact, is. Temperature is, kinetics. The way you prepare your sample has an impact upon the sort of structure that you find. And this is, at least for a theorist, very worrying, because complex. Finally, there's, of course, the presence of RNA or polyelectrolyte and the stoichiometry that plays a role. So this is all that we have to solve. And that's what we're trying to do, although we're not that far yet, I'm afraid. Okay, so Here's two pictures that you might present as an argument why it is okay to visualize captured assembly as a thermodynamic process. In fact, to see viral assembly as supramolecular aggregation, not dissimilar to that what happens in surfactant solutions. This is a recent graph that I nicked from a paper by Johnson and co-workers. This shows the assembly of CCMV coat protein without anything else. Shown here is the dimer fraction in the two components that they find in a size exclusion experiment versus the dimer concentration. And this is the trace of the size exclusion experiment. And what you see is that you have only two main species, being the dimer and the capsid. And the ratio of these two depends on the concentration of protein that you put in. And this answers the question that was raised yesterday about whether or not you have intermediaries. It looks like it that you only have dimers and fully formed capsids. Now, if you then measure the amount of protein in dimers as a function of the dimer concentration, then you'll see that initially all dimers remain monomeric until you hit some critical concentration, after which it remains a constant. From that point on, all the additional dimer is put into capsids.
Okay, what do you mean by the x-axis? The x-axis is the initial concentration.
That's right, the overall concentration of protein that you weighed in, so to speak.
Here kinetics is not an issue.
Here kinetics is not an issue.
Is this reversible?
That is what is claimed. Yes.
That is what is claimed.
It's claimed that it's reversible.
If you reduce the dimer concentration, then these capsids magically disassemble. And
yes, but you have to, I mean, this is an issue of nucleation. So, I mean, Zlotnik has done experiments where he first concentrated material, and you'll find that curve, then diluted back again, and the critical concentrations actually are not identical. There is hysteresis, and this has a kinetic reason. Yes, please.
How do they, if they're diagnosing, if they're analyzing by SCC, how do they know that they don't have disassembly of intermediates in the column?
They don't know this, but the thing is that, as you know, it's actually quite difficult to disassemble a capsid. So I think they're just saved by the fact that these capsids survive very long, even though in the conditions which are suboptimal.
Doesn't that argue, though, that because capsids could survive better than intermediates, which would be more fragile to disassemble, that could be an explanation why it's like that?
That could be an explanation, although people have done scattering experiments and try to model the scattered intensity. And if you wait long enough, the only thing that you need to accurately describe the scattering, X-ray scattering, is to have monomers only and capsids only. So, no, but you're right. This doesn't actually prove you have no intermediaries. But I have arguments why this is. I mean, in pictures, you don't actually see intermediaries either, do you? If you wait long enough. Yeah. I'll show pictures. So anyway, the only reason why I'm showing this is that this looks like a textbook picture of micellization. So this convinces me that virus capsids are like micelles. In a way. This picture here, David will recognize, I suppose. This is an assembly curve of HPV. So this is human papillomavirus. As a function of time, the vertical axis gives you the light scattered intensity. So this is a measure for how many capsids are formed, or how much capsid is formed, as a function of temperature for different concentrations. So if you increase the concentration, you get more capsids, as in fact you would expect from this curve. Now if you zoom in, you'll see that initially nothing happens. There is a lag time.
Time.
This is time in minutes. So you go from well, all the way up to 20 to 50 minutes. So this looks essentially also like experiments that people have done on quenches of surfactants, or even the quenches, you quench a colloidal dispersion into a regime where crystals become stable, and you get the similar sort of kinetics. So it's a nucleated kind of kinetics. So
and the delay time depends on concentration?
I'll come back to that later. So the delay time goes down with increasing concentration.
Right. What power?
It's not a power. I'll come back to that.
Disappoint Michael if it's not a power.
It's not. It doesn't look like a power.
So it's not a reaction.
I'll come back to that if I may. If you allow me to, indeed. Okay. So from now on, I mean, it's hugely simplistic, but to me, virus capsids are like my cells. The analogy was actually also put forward by McPherson in a paper last year. We know that micelle, the shape of a micelle depends essentially on the shape of the surfactant. So whether you have a spherical micelle or a disc-like micelle or a cylindrical micelle or a flat plate depends on the packing of these molecules inside the micelle. I would imagine that similar rules that people have devised for figuring out what surfactant will self-assemble into a sphere or a rod or whatever, similar rules hold also for coiled proteins. Even more so because the proteins are assembled in a quasi-crystalline way. That's just an hypothesis. So, yeah, you know, the hour is almost gone, and I haven't come to the interesting bit yet. This is an overview of my talk. From now, that is. Lunch is over there. That's at 12 o'clock. This is the road to lunch. First thing I'm going to do is outline the mean field theory of empty capsid assembly, which is trivial, but still informative. Then I present recent work where we applied the classical nucleation theory to capsid assembly and try to work out the kinetics. Then I'll come up with a minimal model for the binding strength. So how the binding strength of the coiled proteins that sit inside a capsid depends on pH, salt, temperature, etc., etc. I'll explain a little bit about the cusp pairs that I discussed earlier on. And probably not, but then there is the work on the encapsidation of polyelectrolyte at the end. And I must say I put this bit at the end on purpose.
So this is where genome appears first time?
That's right.
Number 5?
Yes.
Wow.
There's actually a reason for that. You can ask me afterwards why that is. Okay. I apologize for going so slowly. Okay, so people have come up with self-assembly models for viruses a long time ago. In fact, in the 60s and 70s, Max Laufer and Don Kasper have come up with multi-chemical equilibria to describe the self-assembly of tobacco mosaic virus. About 10 years ago, Adam Slotnick did that for spherical polymers, in other words, capsids. And in fact, this image I took from his webpage. These multi-chemical equilibria can be derived also from a free energy. I like free energies better than chemical potentials, which is why I normally do it like this. You write down a dimensionless free energy, F, and you write it as a sum over all species that you have in the solution, so monomers, dimers, trimers, etc., etc., all the way to infinitely large clusters. The first bit of the free energy is just a free energy of mixing, so an ideal free energy of mixing, so rho log rho. This rho log rho thing, we'll try to make the assemblies as small as possible because that increases the translational entropy or the entropy of mixing. The driving force of the assembly is somehow in the free energy of an assembly, G of N, which depends on the size. You could add interactions between the various species. Experiments are normally done at very, very low concentrations, so we can ignore it, or even ignore it because within a fluorotype theory, the excess free energy depends only on the overall concentration of material and not how it is distributed over the various species. So we ignore that. So this is STATMAC 101, I suppose. One cranks the handle, so one minimizes the free energy relative to the distribution, rho of n, of the various species that you have, that you don't know yet. You have to make sure that you don't lose any material, so you have mass conservation. So the total density of monomers in n-mers, the sum of all n-mers, gives you the total concentration phi in your solution, which is why you have to. So the mu is essentially a chemical potential. And what you get is an exponential distribution of the assemblies in terms of the chemical potential, and again this free energy of an assembly. This is the most general form of the law of mass action that you can get, I suppose. This is just law of mass action, as chemists call it. To actually do something, we need to know something about the free energy of an assembly. And the thing is, we don't know very much about it, unfortunately. So what we're doing, why not guess? Oops. You would expect the free energy of an assembly to be extensive in its aggregation number. So my guess would be n times g, and g is some sort of a binding strength. Now, there's going to be corrections to that stemming from the finite size. So we need a model to calculate the corrections to that. I should mention, as we're going to see later on, this binding strength per monomer is on the order of 10 kBT, actually closer to 20 kBT per monomer. So we're talking about 10 kBT per protein.
You're not talking about small capsids, because these large numbers, I think, are characteristic of small capsids.
Right, exactly, yes.
And this large capsids, they're going to be much, much smaller.
That I don't know. So, how do we estimate the free energy penalty of having, for instance, a partially formed capsid, which we model as, a cup? Well, I would guess that you would have a free energy penalty associated with having a rim, because the proteins that sit at the rim have fewer contacts with neighbors than proteins that sit in the middle.
Assume that there's no holes.
There's no holes in this.
Not and in the theory, but I mean in the capsid, the drone capsid.
Well, I'll show you pictures in a minute. This is contentious. I don't believe in holes.
We saw holes yesterday.
But that was in computer.
Okay.
In silico. I'm not sure I believe it, personally. Meaning, I don't believe it. So, how do you... No. So, how do you calculate the rim energy? Well, it's an issue of geometry, isn't it? So I just guess the delta G must be equals, means actually wiggle, is sometimes of a line tension times the length of the contour of this rim. Line tension, okay, wiggle, I'll put a wiggle here too. Gosh, I don't know. I have only one energy scale, so this is my binding energy. I'm going to put a constant in front of it. And then I need some distance measure. So that will be something like the number of proteins I have in my capsid. I beg your pardon?
Can you read the letter that you just drew? is it a
It's
line?
A G. That's my fancy G.
Inside the square root, that one.
This one?
Yeah.
That's a Q. What else? I mean, duh. Something like that. I'm just counting the number of proteins that I have on the surface, and you divide that by the total area of the surface. Yes.
You're assuming a minimal.
You're assuming
that's right. Hang on. Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah.
No.
I'll come back to that later, maybe. So then I need to. No L.
Can I ask a question about this length scale, which is basically it's like the separation between the units on the surface?
That's exactly it.
In the pictures you showed at the beginning, I had the sense that this does not vary so much among the different families. Is it the difference between a big virus and a small virus particle is mainly the T number?
Mm-hmm.
Can you, Can you say what the range is of that length scale?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing is that Q scales like R squared, sure. So this will be a constant.
But each virus is a different protein. I'm just asking, are these proteins all the same size?
More or less.
Viral proteins show closer, two viruses which are very different, they have a very similar basic structure called the Swiss roll structure. So basically the size is similar.
That's right. And then the length, it's just geometry, isn't it? That's 2 pi r sine theta, where this is theta. And the area gives me the number of proteins. So area is like 2 pi r squared, 1 minus, minus cosine theta. That you use, that you plug in. And then the only thing remaining is C. That's this constant. Now, I want to choose C in such a way that I make sure that the monomer does not carry any free energy penalty. So I take as a reference the monomer free energy. And that sets my C. And if I do that, then this is the expression that that I get. It's a rough estimate, but it's not that bad, actually. Anyway, the important thing, and I'll be closing for a break in maybe 5 minutes' time, if that's okay. Okay. It has, so this is plotted delta G versus the aggregation number, so you're closing up the capsid. It has a maximum at half the size, as you would expect, because when it's half the size, you have the maximum rim length. Now, this maximum free energy associated with the rim when it's half-baked, if you can call it that, is a half times G, so the bonding energy, times the square root of Q, Q being the aggregation number. Now, G is on the order of 20 kbt, Q is on the order of, say, 100 or 200, and this gives you a barrier on the order of 50 to 100 kbt. It's huge. It's massive. Is this important? I bet you it's important. It completely, in my view, it suppresses these partially formed capsids. It must suppress them.
Well, it kills the transition.
It makes it slow. Nice. Hang on. It makes it slow.
As slow as breaking carbon bonds.
I'm confused. You have to add to this a linear term, the term proportional to n, so it's just a regular nucleation problem.
That's right. That's right.
So I'll
come back to that.
It's much closer to this.
That's right. Yes. I'll come back to that in a minute when discussing the classical nucleation theory that we've set up. So, anyway, the take-home message is, if you're in equilibrium, then intermediates should be very, very scarce. So, for the thermodynamics, intermediates should be unimportant, and a two-species model should be sufficient. And here again is a picture, Nick, from the UCLA virus group. If you take pictures, you see pictures of viruses, you don't see half-baked viruses. You only see fully formed ones or no.
Well,
unless...
To look at that, you have to look at the boundaries and see how close you have to completion.
That's difficult to say, sure. I mean, that's very difficult to say from these pictures. But, I mean, if you look at pictures like that, they look complete to me.
And it also should tell you how likely you have to have a trimer and tetramer.
Right. It does, of course. I'll come back to that after this slide.
Can you enlighten me? When people say intermediates are unimportant, what's the technical meaning of that exactly? Obviously, to get from here to there, it has to go through the intermediates, and there's a pathway that you care about the barrier of it.
Thank you. Indeed. So, for thermodynamics, if you're interested in how many capsids you have as a function of concentration of protein, the intermediates are not important. If you're interested, how do you get from the monomer state to the fully formed capsid, then the intermediates are hugely important.
When you say thermodynamics, you don't really mean assembly thermodynamics. You just mean thermodynamics of a solution, an equilibrium solution of this stuff.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, the word assembly in your first patent there is an error. It's confusing.
I don't think it's confusing at all. Because it's connected to thermodynamics.
Describing an equation thermodynamics of something that has preset total mass.
That's right. That's right.
You yourself said that it depends on conditions of distribution, right?
Right.
If this is a variable as well, right, then...
Kinetics will, depending on how you prepare your sample, may then dictate what type of shell will form. This is true.
But don't you have to include here all different, some of all different possible types of shells?
Sure, you can do that. Yeah, sure. But the simplest view is this one.
For the kinetics, but not
for the thermodynamics.
For the thermodynamics, you can forget about it. For the kinetics, we have to concern about all possible intermediates.
Yes,
forget about what they're talking about. Different
for the thermodynamics. If you do a population scan, then you can forget about intermediates.
Not intermediates, but different capsid sizes.
Whereas he assumes only one.
Yeah, and
because that quantizes the T numbers, so yeah. He takes either T equals 3 or T equals 1 or T equals 4. So because it's quantized, you have only one size. And
this is what you normally see in experiment, except there are exceptions where you find two different T numbers, or sometimes three different T numbers. But those are exceptions.
I mean, your theory doesn't have in it the thing that selects what the actual size will be.
No, I'm prescribing it. Sure.
Pardon?
I prescribe what size it will be by prescribing Q.
But you determine your free energy formula, which has that encoded in it.
Well, you can if you want. You would just have a summation over the different T numbers. It's not an issue.
Let's say it's the simple thing.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying if I literally look at this formula, which is a term in two terms in it, which are functions of capital N, it would seem that the best thing would be for capital N to get very, very large.
Well, G depends in principle on the T number. That's the answer. Okay? G, it's not an independent of the T number. So in other words, G depends on Q, in other words. And G selects which capsid it wants to form.
He takes here simply the fact from nature that viruses assemble with one T number.
No, I'm perfectly willing to say that. I'm just asking, shouldn't there be in the mathematical description of this is not faithful to nature, because mathematically this says, it seems to be saying you have the lowest free energy state is a state with a very large capital N. And so I'm wishing that there were some term that you just put in there by hand that would express the true fact about that there's a selected T number.
He just assumes that he doesn't show that.
You put a wall in your theory saying that capital N cannot get larger than a certain amount.
Exactly, yes.
We have to try to get beyond number one on this list of six.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I think it's a question about his theory, so I think it's fair to ask.
It's not my theory.
Oh,
it's
okay. Sorry,
something that you would do to get an estimate.
The framework that you're
studying. No, this exercise is just to get you a feel for how big these barriers are. And they're big, right? Anyway, now I just stumbled upon these intermediates and all are important if you look at the assembly kinetics. Because they give rise to lag time, hysteresis, all kinds of phenomena that you would also have in first order phase transitions. And this is an image that I found only very recently by Bertin and co-workers. This is an image, in fact, of BMV, so it's a bromosaic virus, after an acid quench. So they did an acid quench and waited for, in this case, 200 seconds, and they took a picture. This is cryo-EM. And they claim to be able to see partially formed capsids over here and over here. I should mention the actual picture is really large and there's many examples of it. So they claim to be seeing these cup-like structures as intermediaries. Now, of course, you have to be very careful because it's an interpretation of a cryo-EM picture. But they also have scattering data that back up that idea. So it looks like it that capsid assembly, at least for BMV, occurs through the growth of these cup-like structures, and which is why I'm not sure whether indeed these holes form, because they carry a lot of free energy penalty.
Well, but that you wouldn't see on those things. So don't see how you can exclude those.
You can't exclude them, but I mean, if you have a model that tells you what the scattering pattern should look like, presuming you have these in your solution and the scattering pattern coincides with what you measure, then that's, again, it's not proof again, but it's again an indication that assembly kinetics occurs through this type of intermediate state.
Right, but if you have holes in the capsids that are growing, you would not see them in scattering either.
No, but I suspect if you have holes in the intermediates, you also would have holes in the final products, and that there's no reason because it's the same sort of energetics. And that you can rule out because otherwise the genome would escape.
Why would you have holes in the formula?
if you form it, and there would be many holes there, that would mean that you should also expect in the closed shell that would be water. Why? Because the hole forms because of a certain broken holes. So, there would be a lot of holes in the intermediates, and there would be holes in the final.
One more slide.
So why don't we continue?
One more slide, and I hope. No, this is X-ray scattering.
So what was the
shape? Pardon?
What was it? You said light scattering data supported the shape. What was it?
No, X-ray scattering.
What was it? The angle? Was the angular dependent?
That's right, yes. So they actually measured the number of intermediaries as a function of time. So they actually see a certain type of cap occurring and then going away again, and a larger one growing and going away again, etc.
So did it pick up the shape? Did it have the Q dependence?
Yeah. I think these experiments are quite nice. So when I gave this argument, I think 2 weeks ago, David Nelson objected because this is a continuum theory and this is essentially T equal naught. There's no roughness in the model. So the question is, so how accurate is it? It's more accurate than you would expect. There's been recent work by Reardon Tworog from York, I believe, who's got a tiling-type theory to calculate the energetics of partially formed capsids. The work can be found on the preprint site. Was done to model SV40. SV40 virus is a strange virus because it's not a true T number virus, which is why I put the T between quotation marks. It consists of 72 pentamers, and the pentamers are organized in a locally hexagonal symmetry over here, like this one, and the blue ones have locally a pentameric symmetry. If you're interested in the kinetics, the kinetic pathways, you worry about all isomers that you might produce, so you have to account for them and count them. And that's what they did. Now, so plotted here is the number density of N-mers divided by the number density of monomers as a function of the aggregation number. The dots are the calculations by Tworog and co-workers, accounting for all possible isomers, which is why you have many dots. And the red dots are sort of a fit to these data, or these calculations. So it's pretty good.
Have you added the red dots?
Yeah. So this is why, I mean, yes, you can do a full enumeration of all possible intermediates and calculate the distribution of these various intermediates, and what you get is something that is very, very similar to that what you would get from a simple geometric argument that I just gave. And the energies involved are very similar too. They used a total energy of G of -5.9. If I put in -5.9, my curve will creep up a bit and become they will go up a little bit. So you would have a less good fit over here, but a better fit over there. The important thing is, look at the numbers. We're talking here about 10 to the power minus 10. See? So intermediates, thermodynamically.
They adjusted the chemical potential so that rho 1...
That's right, yes, 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 yes. That's one phase point. And
but does error factor of 2 and the minimum gives you a huge error in rate?
That's true.
That's true.
Yes. Sure.
You all you care about is this little tiny minimum. Everything else.
That's true. True. Right. So the curvature there is going to be important. Right.
And yeah. Depth.
Right. Sure. But so.
That's the heated number that we use to fit the enumeration, right?
I beg your pardon?
So the red one is your simple theory.
That's right.
But none of it has relevance to the actual.
No, it's compressed
to model.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
intermediate transition state in chemistry.
Yeah, of course. You can't get estimate of.
Sure. So on that, so you know, it's not so bad. So this is really the last slide before we go out and have coffee. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So this convinces me that a two-state model is good enough. Actually, the model was proposed in 1949 by Wan and Peter Debye, and he modeled actually surfactant assembly into micelles. So if you suppress all intermediates, what you get for the fraction of proteins in capsids, F, you get a universal curve because the aggregation number is large. It goes like 1 minus some phi star, a reference concentration, divided by the concentration of material, and this critical concentration phi star links to the binding energy. So all the information about the assembly is in this energy G. In fact, this allowed Zlotnik to actually measure the binding strength of HBV, so hepatitis B viruses. Plotted against F, so the fraction of protein in capsid versus the normalized concentration. This is our universal curve, actually the Debye's universal curve. The symbols would represent the experimental data by Sirus and Zlotnik for HBV at 3 different concentrations of salt. And what he extracts is a binding strength on the order of 18 kBT, although depending on the concentration of salt, of course. So this is our first estimate of the binding strength. Now, I put here, this is you have a sharp increase, looks like a phase transition. It's not, but it's close enough. If you would look at the heat capacity, for instance, and you let the aggregation number go to infinity, then the heat capacity versus, well, this normalized concentration, it jumps. In reality, because Q is finite, you just have a sharp peak. And this, in fact, would be a way to actually measure C star accurately. The other thing, if you look at the chemical potential, of the proteins as a function of the concentration, it has a sharp bent over here, indicating that we have a phase transition. We're going to use this later on in our nucleation theory. But before that, I think we should have a coffee first.
Let's have just a 5 minutes break.
Okay. Maybe one remark. I'm going to ask quickly as I thought. Robin had asked me to prepare a 60 to 70 minute talk. Mm-hmm. Now, there is this rule of thumb to have one slide per 2 minutes. So I have 30 slides. But here, I think we go like one slide per every 10 minutes, so you can calculate how long this talk will last.
Control that, right. So,
okay, so I have convinced myself, maybe not you, but myself, that this free energy barrier is important when looking at the kinetics of the assembly. We've also seen that the formation of capsids resembles a phase transition. In fact, it resembles a first order phase transition. So our idea was, even though it's not really a phase transition, why not use the classical nucleation theory that people have been using to describe the kinetics of first-order phase transitions? There are all kinds of objections against that, and I'm sure that someone will point me to it. Anyway, there are very many nucleation theories. The classical one is wrong in many ways, but it's the simplest one, which is why we actually use it. And it gives the right trends, even though that the numbers that come out, oh, thanks a lot, the numbers that come out might not be that all that, oh. You're an angel, thank you.
Now start picking it.
Good thing he's a theorist.
The banana. So, the central object in classical nucleation theory is the free energy delta G, or a W, of N for forming a partially formed new phase, so a nucleus. It's written as N times, so N being the number of proteins now in the partially formed capsid, times delta mu. And delta mu is the free energy difference between the fully formed state and the metastable monomeric state in which you start off from. You add to that, this should be negative in principle. You add to that this rim energy that I discussed before as an ansatz to create the simplest possible nucleation theory for capsids, which may be right or may be wrong, but at least this is a first way to deal with the problem. So, the class of free energy.
Just hit the space bar. You heard the spacing out, you hit the space in.
The space bar.
Isn't this a space bar?
You're there.
Right. So, the free energy associated with a cluster of a certain size as a function of the size goes through a maximum. The reason being that even though delta mu is negative, the rim energy is positive. So, if delta mu is positive, it doesn't want to form capsids at all, and you end up with this red curve here. If the monomeric state is metastable, then this free energy goes through a maximum to become negative at some large n. This maximum is the free energy barrier to nucleation, W star. There is a size associated with it, which we call the critical nucleus size, n star. If you plug this into the classical nucleation theory, meaning that that the kinetics only allow for the addition or the detachment of single proteins, that the concentration of monomers stays the same, that the concentration of, in this case, cumers remains zero, which is an ansatz to solve the hierarchy of equations that you have, then you get the steady-state nucleation rate, J, which is proportional to the Boltzmann factor associated with the free energy barrier. We know the free energy barrier because we have a model for the rim energy. You can calculate the lag time meaning the time it takes to get from a non-steady state initially to a steady state nucleation, and it scales like 1 over the curvature of the free energy barrier.
This is using Cramer's theory?
Yes.
What does W star mean?
I beg your pardon?
Numerically, what's the value of W star for your model?
W star, you mean the number?
Yeah. No, it was less than
that. I'll show it in a minute. It's much less. Everything in the theory gets expressed into a supersaturation. In our case, is the log of the volume fraction or the concentration divided by the critical concentration. And then in front of it, we still have this free energy of association G in it. In the classical nucleation theory of a liquid, you would have a similar expression, except that G is replaced by surface tension. In our case, we have a direct connection between phi star, the critical concentration, and G. So the surface tension, in this case, or the line tension, gets adjusted by the free energy of association.
Well, what's the definition of quench then?
I beg your pardon?
What's the definition of a quench?
It's how deeply you quench into the metastable phase.
And so in what units is it measured?
This is dimensionless. G is dimensionless, it's a dimensionless free energy.
Oh.
And Q is a number.
G is measured in kT.
That's right, yes. It's just a measure on, you know, how metastable the solution. Pardon?
Somewhere quite a period, I couldn't understand.
Pardon?
So could you say again what the quench depth is?
The quench depth is, we have seen, okay, I'll just draw a picture.
That means the distance in the base background?
That's right. So you have your assembly curve. This is the concentration. This is the critical concentration. And the quench depth is essentially how deeply in the polymerized regime you quench the system.
So it's units of concentration, in a sense, that's sort of.
Whatever. Here it's dimensionless. It's dimensionless.
It's whatever units phi is in.
That's right, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's comparative.
So this distance essentially is this quench depth.
Quench depth is from the bound, not from the...
Excuse me, you're right. So it's actually from over here. Yeah, thank you. So, you turn the handle, and we can calculate the nucleation barrier. For shallow quenches, meaning that I quench from here to here, very close to the critical concentration, I have the maximum barrier at the same number that I've shown before. That's this 1/2 times g times the square root of q, and that will be the 50 to 100 kT that I have. If I increase the quench depth, this number goes down. Now, here we already have the first difference between capsid assembly and a normal phase separation process, because the barrier has actually a maximum which is not infinite. So that's the big difference between normal phase separation. Just to give you an idea.
That's simply because the system is fine.
Right, of course, yeah.
The same is for my cells.
Right. Yeah. You can calculate the nucleation barrier, the nucleation size, the critical nucleus size, again as a function of the quench depth. The largest critical nucleus is half the size of the fully formed capsid, but if you quench more deeply, it becomes smaller.
Could you just read the lag time equation? Can you just tell me if that says 1 over value
W star this is the second derivative with respect to the aggregation number. You can calculate lag time. Again, it's a function of quench depth. There is a maximum lag time when the quench is very shallow, and this lag time decreases with increasing quench depth. There's no scaling with a simple power law because rho goes like a log, right? Gamma goes like a log. If you now calculate nucleation rates, then there's no longer a universal description in terms of this single parameter, gamma. The binding strength comes in. So what we see is that the nucleation rate, as you would expect, goes up with increasing quench depth, but it also goes up with increasing binding strength. Now, in experiment, you would measure this as a function of the log of the concentration, for instance, and you would get a slope. From the slope, by invoking the nucleation theorem, you can actually get the critical nucleus size n star. Now, none of the experiments that I have seen, people have actually measured the critical concentration. So in these experiments, people don't know how deeply they are quenching. So my message would be, please, if you do an experiment, first measure your phase diagram and then do a quench experiment. And that's something that has not been done yet, as far as I know. Right.
How much do things change because the diagrams are hard to read?
Are they? It's a huge, this is the log of a red. You go from 100 to 200 to whatever. And these are huge changes. So you can get any slope that you can that you want. And in experiments, people see slopes of 2, 3, 5, 7. And it's interpreted in terms of a critical nucleus. But if you don't know where you are in the phase diagram, that doesn't mean very much. So, and this makes comparison to experiment very, very difficult. Now,
So when you have a dimensionless rate here of 100, that's basically saying there's no more barrier, right?
Yes.
Your original one was
right, yes. 100 kV. That's right, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you have extreme supersaturation.
Yeah.
You are just rolling down the hill.
That's
gamma,
right.
And gamma was logarithmic ratio of concentration?
Of the actual concentration relative to the critical.
So how many decays above critical
have this, so
counting decays above.
Right. So this is about 5 over 5 star of 10.
So each here. One is 10.
So this is about 10.
10 5 star, then you have 100 5 star.
That's right. That's right, yeah. Roughly. So you'd have to actually go to really, really deep quenches to actually reduce the barrier sufficiently that you don't see it anymore. That's the claim, anyway. So this is the only fit that I've been able to do so far. These are measurements done by Cassini and David, who was involved. He's going to talk about this next week, I believe.
Yeah.
These are experiments done on human papillomavirus. That's one of those oddballs, q equals 72, so 72 pentamers. This is an image that I nicked from, can you believe it, the Wikipedia. anyway, experiments were done at pH 5.2, at 0.5 molar, at 24 C. Now, as I just said, I don't know C star.
How do you propose to measure it?
Pardon?
How
How do you propose to measure?
To C star. Heat capacity measurement, for instance, or fitting, what you can do. I mean, it takes a very long time to have only very few capsids formed. But what you can do is do experiments here, where assembly is fast, and then fit the theoretical prediction through it, and then find C star.
You just do what Slotnik did.
That's exactly what Slotnik did. Yeah, exactly what Slotnik did.
Using theory.
Yes.
Law of mass action.
And if you don't want to use theory, then you have to be just very, very patient.
Exponentially
patient. Now, I had to presume now, I had to assume a C star. And I just said, okay, let's just presume that the C star is at the very first point that I measured. So this is the lag time in minutes versus the concentration in milligrams per liter. I fix this point. Then I adjust G, the binding energy, in order to get a good fit. That's this blue line. I extract a G, which is minus 19 kBT, which is actually, incidentally, almost identical to the one that Slotnik obtained for its HBV. Is this coincidence? I don't know. And then, since I have a G, I can recalculate C star. And that's pretty close to the one that I chose here.
Very nice.
Which is, so it's internally consistent, at least.
72 you fixed
equal
and fit,
not
just
yeah,
from the
set. That's right, yeah. So I was quite surprised when I saw this, and it probably it's a fluke, but I don't know.
So 72 corresponds to how? What fraction of the total number of?
Oh, oops, excuse me?
How big is the critical nucleus then? I don't know how big HPV is.
This is pseudo T equals 7.
So this corresponds
to Q
what's
equals.
What's the size of the critical nucleus, and is it half?
Here it should be a half.
Okay.
Exactly.
What does Q mean? Can you
a Q is the aggregation number of the complete capsid.
Okay.
It's the number of proteins.
That's right. Pentamers in this case.
How do you get a half? How do you get the critical nucleus and half from this?
That's what I get from theory. I know that if you invoke the nucleation theorem, you get
it. The Q that you call the 60T in your...
That's right. But in this case, this is a non-T equals 7. This is a pseudo-T equals 7. And the monomers are actually the pentamers here.
It's the number.
Yeah.
It's the number. So it's
2 to the 4 divided by 5. Yeah. So this disagrees with the nucleation theorem. So we're not quite sure yet why that is. But then that's ongoing work.
I don't understand what you're saying. This disagrees with which... A statement you made earlier?
No, if you can use the nucleation theorem to estimate from the scattering, from the experiments, from the nucleation rate, the critical nucleus size.
Right.
You find a power law of 2 if you draw the log of the rate versus the concentration, the log of the concentration, and that points at a nucleus size of 2.
Right.
I find that it's 36. So there is an inconsistency there.
And what would be the time? What is the barrier at this point?
I don't know by heart. I honestly don't know.
I'm sorry. I must have missed the argument before. This is something I like to understand here. Where is the half? So it's always a half.
No. It depends on the question. No, hang on. If this is C star,
a very weak supersaturation, and it becomes less than that at higher supersaturation.
But the thing is, you assumed a half here. I mean, did you try fitting?
I assumed that this is C star. It's an assumption. It might be wrong.
But if you try moving that to see whether you...
Yeah, I haven't...
But it's unlikely to be C star, right? Because C star means you're going to have one of these humongous variables.
Yeah. So the next step would be, in order to get these numbers to get to be consistent, is to move this one back. And you don't need to move it back very much.
But you expect that to be an extreme upper bound.
So. Right. Sure. But this is the best I can do right now, because it's not been measured.
So I guess I'm curious. You said that there was another way in which you evaluated that the critical size was 2. From this, didn't you just say that?
Yeah.
And why can't you adjust a C star until that's in agreement with the...
That I can do. I haven't done that. Yeah, sure.
But I won't ask this of anyone if no one else is interested, but I didn't understand the method that you got that.
It's how rates depend on concentration, the power of that.
So is that something
the
theory or
empty,
that
aggregation.
Is that something that can be deduced from
yes,
the theory?
Yes. Sure. Yeah. It's called the nucleation theorem, which actually is more generally valid than the classical nucleation theory. Mm-hmm. But our nucleation theory is consistent with the nucleation theorem, which is good.
But now, are you saying that if you did make that adjustment, you think that the value of G in this bit would not change very much?
No, it will change a bit. But then again, you know, C star depends exponentially on G. No. So if
it changes to 17, I would say that was not very much.
Yeah, right. It should
but
be.
I don't know if you have an intuition for
no,
that.
Not at this moment. This is all very fresh and.
If you start with the orders measured below this value.
The only thing you can say it has to be less than whatever the endpoint is of the blue curve.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because otherwise, David wouldn't have seen his
symbol.
It could be anywhere between zero and that.
In terms of the critically existing half, I mean, this is just one case where it could fit.
Right.
It could actually be smaller and still fit. I mean, if you just look at the shape of that curve.
Sure. Yes. Because it depends rather weakly on G. Yes, I'm sorry. Not my fault. Okay. We have seen two numbers now, two estimates for G, minus 19, and we had minus 18. So, and this...
G was for the same virus?
No, a different virus.
So why would there be anywhere?
There must be a reason for that, because we get exactly the same number for tobacco mosaic virus.
Okay.
So, we have... How much? I have 15 minutes. So I think I'll just do the binding strength estimate. And then if anyone is interested, I can give the rest of the talk in one of the afternoon sessions.
Well, what we'll do is that you go on until maybe 10 past 12. People go for lunch, and you talk for whoever is interested.
Okay, yeah, sure, fine.
Can you give us kind of a preview of coming attractions? Maybe
we already did it, actually, some time ago.
That's right.
Sorry.
So we have various ways now of estimating this binding strength. So now what we want is to get a feel for where this comes from. So we need to worry about what interactions contribute to the binding strength of capsid proteins in capsids. If you look at a coat protein, this is an image, a model of the coat protein of tobacco mosaic virus from both sides. And color-coded is here the charge, the distribution. In red is a net positive charge. In blue is negative charge. So what we're looking at is a hugely complex quotation mark colloid with a very complex charge distribution. But if you look at this protein when it's assembled into a helix, then what you see is that that you have a lot of red spots very close into this, what will you call that? Like a
spiral?
A spiral. Very close together. So this surely means that that one of the interactions should be Coulomb repulsion, destabilizing these capsids.
Sorry, on the side that is facing of the, are those red spots on both the top and the bottom sides?
Yeah, it's like a tube, that's a cylindrical tube, and this it's lined with positive charge. The reason for that is because that's where the...
No, I'm asking, they're stacked on top of one of these...
Right.
Proteins are stacked on top of another, and I'm asking: is the face which is looking at the top, at the one on the top, red as well as the face which is looking at the one that's below it?
Are you talking about this bit or about this bit?
Top and bottom.
This. Well, this is just.
In a part. What's above the red spot?
This here.
The next.
Next turn.
If you put the next disc on top of it, would that be also red?
Right. Yeah. Sure. Of course. Yeah.
Would it be red on the bottom side of the next disc?
Yes,
is what I'm
asking. His answer is yes.
No, he meant it was red on the top side of the next disc, just like the first one.
Right. So what you have is a tube, a helical tube, which is lined by positive charge.
Never mind.
The reason for that is that that's where the RNA goes.
The question was, if red is here, what is on the other side?
I think we asked that question five times and
I don't think it's important.
Yeah.
It's just to get... So, now the other thing is that's these Caspar pairs I mentioned, there's hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds stabilize these structures I mean, we even know where they are. This is for TMV. There's other interactions that are important. For instance, in CCMV, CCMV binds calcium 2 plus, in fact, using the same acidic groups. So here we have Coulomb repulsion. We've got hydrogen bonds that stabilize the capsid. We've got ionic interactions that stabilize these assemblies.
The calcium ion for CCMV fits in these three negative charges which you draw in green there, right?
Yeah.
And this is also lining this inner.
That's right. Yeah. So we can make up a list of all kinds of contributions to the free energy. So there's Coulomb interactions, which could be repulsive and attractive. The cusp pairs I mentioned, ionic bonds involving multivalent ions. There's hydrogen bonds I just mentioned. There are hydrophobic interactions. In fact, TMV, for instance, becomes more stable if you increase the temperature up to a point, that is, before the protein itself falls to bits. There might be steric interactions. Some people claim that there is conformational switching, that conformational switching is important. Van der Waals interactions, chemical bonds, etc., etc., etc.
So,
yeah, some of these viruses mature and form disulfide bonds or other.
HK97 cross-linked chemical bonds.
Yeah. So I'm just going to focus on the main ones. The model I'll be presenting is really, really simple. Really simple. It focuses on Coulomb interactions, Coulomb repulsion, that is, and on hydrophobic interactions, which drive the self-assembly of many a virus. And this has been proposed already many years ago by Bancroft, Caspar, Laufer, and even Kautzmann, who suggested that protein folding is driven by hydrophobic interactions. After the break, I'll present a model which also includes the Caspar pairs. So what's the model? Well, you wouldn't believe it, how simple it is. This is an image of a calculation done on the electrostatics of a complete virus, in this case of CCMV. So people solved the Poisson-Boltzmann equation in this hugely complex geometry and calculated the surface potential. A red surface potential now means negative charge. A blue color means positive charge.
That was the opposite of the previous picture.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, but it's not my picture. I nicked
like
it.
Red stage and blue stage.
Yeah, I just nicked it. So this is the outer view and this is the inner view. So here again, now for the circle virus, we have a lot of positive charge sitting on the inside. So this surely destabilizes this state. And at least, you know, if the salt concentration is not too high, you might imagine coming up with highly idealized models. For instance, where you say, well, you know, most of the charges sit here on the inside, so that will dominate my self-interaction. I can make an infinitely thin shell and put charges on it and try to solve the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, or better still, because that I can't solve analytically, invoke a Debye-Hückel approximation. Or if you say, well, that's really too simple, you could even have two infinitely thin shells with different surface charge density sigma. Or if you don't like that, you could say, well, why not distribute a net charge over a finite volume, solve the Debye-Hückel, and calculate the self-energy. And that's what we did. So this is standard Debye-Hückel theory. Why Debye-Hückel? Because then we can solve the equations analytically. Psi is the potential. Lambda D is the Debye length, the screening length. Lambda B, Gehring length. I is the ionic strength. And I'll come back to this, very important. Ionic strength of the solution, given in terms of the number density of positive ions and their valency squared, and that of the negative charges as well. So what we do to calculate the self-energy, we use the Debye charging process. And then we run into difficulties because we have to subtract a reference state, namely that of the monomer. Now, how do you define a monomer reference state for an infinite shell, infinitely thin shell? I don't know. So what we just use is a spherical colloid and calculate the self-energy of that and subtract that from the self-energy of the fully formed capsid times Q or something.
I thought I understood what you said until you said that. You have a charge on a thin shell.
Yeah.
You're going to use a charging process, not of charging up the thin shell, but of charging up the entire system.
That's right, yeah, sure, yeah.
and you're saying you need a reference thing.
He wants to calculate the free energy of assembly, so he wants to compare the electrostatic free energy of the assembly structure and of the disassembly structure. And the problem is how to estimate the free energy of the disassembly.
Which would be a biological salt of little bits of surface.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Pass those chocolates around while you're not able to talk. This is a hostile act in our lab, and that chocolate's accumulated at one point.
That's a sample.
That's it. Well, yeah. Yeah, think of your buddy here.
Me? I have
see to see if he can catch it. See if he can catch it.
You too. Oh, oops. Oh, sorry.
Increasing or decreasing free energy as you do this.
Anyway, so to, in order to somehow, it turns out that the self-energy depends very crucially on how you model the monomer. So what we did to sort of fix things is to demand that if we let the Debye length go to zero, that the self-energy should be going to zero as well to first order. And if you do that, then you get a self-energy.
Energy going to zero.
The self-energy difference between the proteins inside a capsid and the free protein.
Why should it go to zero?
Because all interactions are screened and the proteins inside a capsid should not be able to feel their neighbors anymore. That's an assumption.
Because the difference between zero and zero is zero.
He said that the Debye length is zero, so he turned off electrostatics all completely.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused by that because, I mean, it seems like for the same shell, if you broke it up into two different size monomers, would you have two different disassembled?
Yeah.
So it seems like there's actually information missing.
Yeah. No, there is information missing, and which is why, in fact, I'll be ignoring this completely. The most important thing is that the self-energy as a function of the Debye length relative to the size of the capsid has a bit over here in which it scales like the surface charge density squared times the charge surface area per monomer times the product of the Bjerrum length and Debye length. If I would ignore the self-energy of the monomers, then this bit over down here goes away. And this is actually what we did. So we're just now going to presume that this is more or less right, and see where that carries us. So a minimal model has two contributions. The Coulomb proportional that I just calculated. I have a driving, I need a driving force. The driving force here is the hydrophobic attraction between apolar patches on the proteins. And the binding strength that I get is given by this expression over here. It depends on temperature, pH, and ionic strength. The first term comes from the hydrophobic attraction, gamma being the surface tension of the hydrophobic patches times the area of the of these hydrophobic patches. It tells you how much free energy you gain by removing those hydrophobic patches from contact with water onto each other. Opposing assembly is the Coulomb repulsion that I have here. Now, of course, the surface charge density will depend on pH, and you need a model for that. Now, the simplest possible model that you can induce or use is this one. This is the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation in terms of the number of positive charges, number of negative charges, and the pKs of the acidic and basic groups. This is, of course, a huge simplification. I should mention that in principle, the surface charge density should be temperature dependent. I'm going to ignore that completely. I'm also completely ignoring the sole dependence of the pKs, just for sake of simplicity. Now, people have done experiments as a function of temperature, so I need to worry about the temperature dependence of this binding energy, G of T. If you do a Taylor expansion around some reference temperature, T naught, I'll have the binding strength at T naught, and then the enthalpy of this binding strength times, well, the temperature scale. It turns out that this enthalpy of binding is totally dominated by the hydrophobic interaction and has hardly any contributions from the electrostatic part. And this is a prediction, which is testable.
The enthalpy of contrarians that are localized when you do this, is it possible? Is it somewhere in there or not?
Within this approach, you know, it's...
Because that's usually the most important term.
Which one?
Enthalpy of contrarians.
Contrarian
release. Yeah. There's no counter-ion release in this model at all.
supposed to be built in, but I'm not, I don't see it.
It's the Bihumble theory, which is
It's not in there.
No.
It's not in there explicitly, but it's to the extent that you're using that approximation, it's there.
And the prediction of huge just entropy comes from the redundancy for your federal progress, right?
Right. Which is... So this is now, this is not a prediction, right? And here is a comparison with experimental data obtained by Slotnick and co-workers. Plotted is the total binding strength of HBV. So this is, what is that again?
Hepatitis B virus.
As a function of temperature at four different concentrations of salt. And the prediction was that the temperature dependence should be salt independent. And that's more or less what we see here. So that's all right. Notice the numbers. This is 2,000 kBT. So this is quite a lot. This gives us the number that I quoted earlier, about 18 or 19 kBT per, in this case, protein dimer. From the slope, I can now extract the enthalpy of the hydrophobic patches. What do I get? Well, I get about minus 13 kBT. If you have an estimate for the size of the hydrophobic patches, and we have an estimate from molecular modeling, that it corresponds to an excess surface enthalpy of minus 3.8 millinewton per meter. Notice the sign of the excess surface enthalpy is negative. These are hydrophobic patches, but they actually like contact with water, if it weren't for the entropy. How do we get information about the entropy? By looking at the salt concentration dependence of these data. That's plotted here. Plotted here is the binding strength as a reference temperature versus the predicted 1 over the square root of concentration of salt. This doesn't prove that the Bihumble theory is right, but it's not inconsistent with it. The slope to that curve gives me the surface charge density, which turns out to be about, say, 1 charge per square nanometer. From the abscissa, I get the surface free energy of the hydrophobic patches, amounting to a plus 19 kBT. This translates into a surface tension of these hydrophobic patches.
How is the sigma reason with the actual protein structure?
It's quite reasonable. If you look at Johnson, he would estimate 10 to 13 charges per capsid protein. That's the standard.
Overall or plus?
Per protein. So per capsid protein, the estimate is between 10 to 13 charges based on the chemical structure.
Overall, so this charge is
concentrated
at what
area,
right?
Sorry?
What's the area of the protein? How many square nanometer? 5, 10? What's the square area? What's the area of the protein?
Well, the charge bit is, this is the number, 23 square nanometers per protein.
So about 10 to 13 charges per square nanometer, per 23 nanometer square.
Which is quite reasonable. It's a bit high, actually, but still.
Pick the surface potential and check that the Bihumble approximation.
Yeah, it's not valid.
It's not valid.
No.
So it's bigger than kBT.
It's about the surface potential calculates about 70 millivolts.
So counter-ion condensation must play a role.
Yes, absolutely.
And the charge is not over the whole product, but in a small portion of it, right?
It's complicated. In some cases, it might actually be in disordered tails, which might go way
I wanted to ask that, too. When you quoted this estimate by Johnson, that's on all different sides of the protein.
On the inside. This is the positive charge on the inside.
This is the face overall, which is facing the interior of the capsid.
That's right.
Only.
And then there are also a few oppositely charged on the outside. So on the inside, it need not line the interior. It can actually go into the
capsid. But that's included. He has a shell.
He treats it as a flat shell.
Yeah, sure. You've got to do something, I suppose. Surface tension of about 5 millinewtons per meter, which is equivalent to surface tension between water and...
How thick was the shell compared to the you were using compared to the viromine?
The shell is about... Well, for HBV, it's got this complicated spiky structure, but...
Well, in your model, I'm talking about. You had this spherical shell you were...
Here, it's infinitely thin. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. And the reason is that essentially the shell thickness is small on the scale of the radius, so that should be an important parameter. It's not actually true, but
can you remind what is the actual value of the Debye length?
It's tiny.
Yeah.
Because it scales like 0.3 nanometers divided by the square root of the concentration, so it's tiny. Which is why it's so surprising that this actually works. Now, the reasoning why it could work is because even when the Debye length is very small, you would have charged patches interacting. And it so happens that the interaction between two charged patches scales in the same way with Debye length, Vm length, and surface charge density. So this is why it also works at high salt, presumably. So this takes me to the phase diagram. So plotted here is the protein concentration versus ionic strength. There's a sharp crossover between having no capsids and having capsids. And what you can do, you could go from here to here in a straight line by increasing the ionic strength. What happens is they get very sharp increase of the fraction of protein inside in capsids. This is an actual experiment. Again, fraction of protein in capsids versus the ionic strength, actually the salt concentration. We have taken care of the buffer. There's also a buffer in this. These are experimental data points, the red dots. This is called the E antigen of hepatitis B. It forms TCl3 shells. And this is our theoretical fit, and we can extract from that then the surface charge density, which is slightly lower than that of the core protein of HBV. So we can make...
Do you remember in your Debye-Huckel calculations what kind of potentials these poor guys were encountering?
I beg your pardon?
Do you remember in your Debye-Huckel calculations what magnitude of potentials these poor guys were encountering as they were scrunched together?
Well, it's more than 1 kT.
Well, that much could be figured, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can make a
very, very often things like effective pH and all this come into it.
Well, one
right.
Square nanometer is usually beyond the range of the.
Yeah, point. So it's a miracle that it sort of works.
Okay, if you say miracle, then I'm more comfortable.
Yeah. No, as long as you don't have anything else, this is the best we have got so far. And you can try and do better than this. But there's not that much experimental data, I must say. So hopefully this inspires experimentalists to actually do more measurements, to actually really, really precisely measure these phase diagrams. Here is the image that we have, phase diagram as a function of the acidity, CPH, protein concentration. Now, the crossover between no capsids and capsids is not a monotonic curve, but it has a minimum. Minimum occurs at the PI, the isoelectric point, right? So on this side, the proteins are positively charged, and this side that they're negatively charged. You can do an experiment, and people have done experiments as a function of pH. This isn't at a given concentration of protein, you just increase the pH. These are experiments on CCMV, fraction protein versus pH. These are the experimental data points, the red dots. And this is our theoretical fit through it. Works quite well. We can extract then an isoelectric point from the fitting. And we get
the same virus or different virus?
This is the E antigen of hepatitis B, and this is CCMV, which is a plant virus. So this one, they're both TCl3 viruses. We extract an isoelectric point of 4.6, which actually is a bit high. The experimental isoelectric point is 3.8. So that should be about here. So I have a reason.
That's where the maximum.
I beg your pardon?
That's where the maximum.
That's right, sure.
It's not a worry physicist.
Yeah, indeed. So, it seems to work. It shouldn't work because this is all just too bloody simple. Let's now test this idea of doing the Debye-Huckel and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. These equations describe my capsid assembly model in terms of the physical properties of the proteins. We have surface tension of the hydrophobic patches, we've got the surface charge density, what we call ionic strength dependence, we've got the dependence of the surface charge density on the pH, etc., etc. This set of equations should be a function of ionic strength only. So if I use different salts, I should get this, the exactly the same results. The words, oh dear, spring to mind. Plotted here is the scattered intensity, again, for HBV.
CCMV has this beautiful receptor place for calcium ions. How can you expect that it doesn't care whether it's calcium or magnesium?
Sure, sure. This is exactly the reason. Although it's not sure for HBV whether it actually has this pocket. So scattered intensity versus ionic strength, not counting the buffer. I mean, that's I got these data from Stephen Stray, communicated to me through Adam Slotnick. Well, these are assembly data for different salts. So I always forget in English, kalium.
Potassium.
I'm sorry. Potassium chlorate, sodium chlorate, chloride, and you've got magnesium, calcium, and nickel, and zinc, and terbium, which has three positive charges. And the curves do not at all superimpose. Okay. What's wrong? Well, we know what's wrong. Well, there's two reasons. First of all, if you account for the presence of the buffer, then all these curves move on top of each other. But still, you would have a difference between the monovalent and the polyvalent ions. And that is, of course, well, one reason is the breakdown of dibiochemical theory. We know from experiments that zinc actually binds to HBV, and that causes a conformational change. There are specific binding, the specific binding. Our coarse grain picture might be totally off. I mean, it's really guessing that it works in some cases, but in this case, it might also contribute. So, on that note, I would say a specific binding you can put in by hand, and that's exactly what we've done for TMV. And if anyone is interested, I'll be talking about that after lunch. And I would thank you for your attention. And it's okay if you don't show up. Thank you.
I'm going to talk here.